From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The scholar Russell Stevenson says in Mormonism's earliest days, there was a vision for what he calls a multi-ethnic Zion, that all races would be included in this kingdom of God on earth. And for a time, it seemed to be so. Early Mormon settlers were friendly with African Americans. But when they came west, this vision began to change. Stevenson says Mormons established a new racial community where they began to embrace their own whiteness. Stevenson explores this transition in a book that tells the story of Elijah Abels, a black man who was an early convert to Mormonism and a friend of Joseph Smith. In fact, Smith gave him the Mormon priesthood. Stevenson will join us to talk about his book. It's called Black Mormon. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. People are often surprised when they hear about Elijah Abels. Abels was a black man and an early convert to Mormonism. He was a friend of Mormon founder Joseph Smith. And here's the surprising part. Smith ordained Abels to the Mormon priesthood. It's surprising because Mormons denied blacks the priesthood for most of their history. The ban, of course, was reversed in 1978. But the Mormon scholar Russell Stevenson says racial inclusion was part of the earliest beliefs of Mormons. Early Mormon settlers were friendly with African Americans, for example. In fact, it was one of the reasons they were persecuted in places like Missouri. But Stevenson says when they came west, these beliefs began to evolve. He says Mormons established a new racial community, one where Elijah Abels didn't fit in so well. His book is called Black Mormon, and he's joining us today to talk about it. Russell Stevenson is an independent historian who's worked for the LDS Church Archives. He's taught history and religion at Brigham Young University as well as the Salt Lake Community College. And he's joining us here in the studio. And Russell Stevenson, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Doug.
Well, let's start with a name, because those who have heard this story may have heard Elijah Abel, not Abels. You say Abels. Let's get that out of the way.
Yes, that is by far the most common question that I get. And it's really based in the documentary evidence. And anyone who chooses to read the book can see that for themselves. I have original images in the volume. Essentially, we have two manuscripts that give us his signature, yeah, or what supposedly is his signature. In 1854, which is the earliest example of this, he wrote a letter to Brigham Young explaining his experience crossing the plains. And it was signed Elijah Abels with an S at the end, A-B-L-E-S. The second example is from 1858. And that is a letter, or rather a sales invoice, that Elijah signed. And it was signed Elijah Abel, A-B-L-E.
Yeah.
So those are the two defensible candidates for the spelling of his name.
But you chose Abel's?
I did choose Abel's because that was the earliest documentary evidence we have.
Doesn't really matter that much, does it?
As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, spellings of names were really fluid, and you can find pretty much every conceivable variation for that spelling.
You say the ghost of Elijah Abels. I'm going to use Abels because you do in the book. You say the ghost of Elijah Abels haunts the Mormon people, but you say few know what that ghost looks like or even what he wants. Explain what you mean.
Now, that's an excellent question, Doug. In the Mormon tradition, we are very familiar with and are comfortable with the idea of ghosts and of familiar spirits, or as the Book of Isaiah calls it, voices from the dust. That's a part of our cultural worldview. You know, we like to take tours of Book of Mormon lands in Central America. Or we like to visit the Hill Cumorah and, you know, think of a people who have a message for us, even though they are not here. And as far as I'm concerned, the story of Elijah Abels fits well within that tradition. Yet, for some reason, and we can talk about this later on, we have not really come to grips with that ghost in the same way that we've come to grips with, say, the voices from the dust that are depicted in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah. You say many Mormons simply choose to kind of pretend it didn't happen, Elijah Abels.
Many do. And that's because Elijah Abels, more than many figures in Mormon history, they problematize a narrative that many of us have been raised with. Hmm. And it's not comfortable for people to problematize narratives. They like what they've been told, and they choose to function within that.
But let me explain what you mean, because it's kind of that conundrum in some way. If, in fact, Elijah Abels did receive the priesthood from Joseph Smith, then, as you put it in the book, not only did the Mormon people promote racist policies after Joseph Smith was killed, but they also made a conscious choice to deviate from the path that Smith seems to have laid out, because, you know, he seems to have found it acceptable to ordain a black man. So is that the problematize you're talking about?
Essentially, yes. Many Latter-day Saints have been raised with the assumption that blacks could not hold the priesthood until 1978, right, and that there were absolutely no exceptions to the rule or anything other than that.
This is how it always has been.
This is how it indeed. And until about 1973, most people accepted that assumption. Things began to change around that time.
Right. But you say there is another way of looking at this. And that is, you say this in the book, and I want to get you to talk about this, that the way to sort of think about this in a different way is to remove what you say are these walls between the rank and file members, the congregation, and the leaders. Explain what you mean.
So one commonality I found both between adherents to the faith and critics is that both of them tend to point to church leadership when they are attempting to define Mormon culture, mm-hmm, doctrine, or lifestyle. You know, they catalog a series of statements from Brigham Young, Joseph Smith, or others, and they say that that is what makes up Mormonism.
Yeah. So this quote from Joseph Smith about blacks, this says this. Brigham Young said this about blacks, this says this. And that's how we define the argument, is simply based on those quotes.
Indeed, indeed. But I would suggest to you that we're only getting half the picture. That is a legitimate historical exercise and tremendously useful. But equally important is that we look at what ordinary Latter-day Saints thought and believed on the ground.
So in this sense, this is what you're talking about when you say that we need to understand Mormonism as an organic entity rather than a corporation. Church leaders, if in that case, church leaders no longer dominate the story, that it's not just leaders expressing an opinion that, you know, the rank and file obey, but that I think here's how you put it, it takes a village to exclude a child or a people, right? That this is not just leaders, it's not just rank and file, it's all this entity together.
Indeed. And one thing that we see is that at times, especially when it came to matters of race, the rank and file or mid-level leaders within the Mormon community ended up kind of pushing the conversation in a certain direction in spite of what Joseph Smith and Brigham Young said. As late as March of 1847, Brigham Young supported Joseph Smith's vision of inclusion.
Yeah. We're going to get to that as we go, so I want to talk about that. But let's sort of establish where you stand, because I want to get this out of the way. You're an active Orthodox member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
That is correct, whatever orthodoxy means.
Well, yeah, active temple-going guy. Yeah, that's
yes.
How I identify it, and
yes,
that's where you are. Does this make you nervous, this conversation, at all? I mean, because, I mean, when we're talking about contradictions, does that make you nervous?
You know, maybe at some point in my life it might have, but the more I have this conversation, the more I'm finding that the Mormon people are ready to have it. Recently, the Scriptures Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they included a heading for Official Declaration Number 2 stating that African-American men were ordained to the priesthood during Joseph Smith's lifetime.
Right.
So the Latter-day Saint community is ready to have this conversation, especially within through the lens of a man like Elijah Abels, who was so committed to the faith over the course of his lifetime.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about Elijah Abels. It seems we don't know much about his life before he became a Mormon, I guess.
You know, we do have limited information. We know that he was from Western Maryland, which was indeed a slave state.
Right.
And the census numbers indicate that slaves outnumbered free blacks in that region. So statistically speaking, Elijah Abels was likely a slave.
Mm. But we don't know that for sure.
We do not know that with certainty. So I'm not comfortable nailing it down to that, as some have. But we do know that he made his way to Cincinnati by 1832. Right. And really, that is the first hard and fast evidence we have of his existence as a human being, is that he was baptized in September of 1832 by a man named Ezekiel Roberts.
Yeah. So he's, before we get to that, though, so we're not sure exactly when he was born either, 1808, between that and 1812, and we think he was raised on a plantation in Maryland?
We really don't have any evidence for that either.
Huh.
He's very much an enigma prior to 1832.
So the first evidence, as you said, is in Ohio, where he's reported to be baptized. Ezekiel Roberts. Now, that's interesting because help me understand the significance of the fact that that he was baptized at all. This isn't an era of slavery, of course. So was it at all controversial that he was baptized?
You know, we have no evidence of that being the case. We do know that Cincinnati was an ethnically diverse place. You know, there was a black slum, and chances are that, you know, that the Latter-day Saints were forced to coexist, you know, with this community to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the existence of a black person, you know, would not have been remarkable, not nearly as remarkable as it was around the same time in Kirtland.
You say in the earliest days of Mormonism, there was this hope for a multi-ethnic Zion, that the original Zion experiment included, I suppose, all races. Was this Joseph Smith's vision in particular?
This was really centered on Joseph Smith, and it was a vision that he held even in spite of the opinions of some of his closest confidants, men like Parley P. Pratt, Zebedee Coltrane, Orson Hyde, all at various times and in various ways criticized this vision. You know, Zebedee Coltrane, when he was asked to administer temple ordinances to Elijah Abels in Kirtland, he pushed back. And later he would say that the only reason I did it at all is because Joseph Smith told me to.
There's a really interesting quote you have. Coltrane is assisting in the ordination of Elijah Abels.
Not the ordination, rather the temple ordinance.
Temple ordinance. But he said he had never felt so unpleasant in all his life. So he's a follower of Joseph Smith, this man, this white man. But he finds it really distasteful to be doing something like this, to giving such a privilege to a black man.
Indeed. So as much as he adored Joseph Smith, this was a line that he felt very uncomfortable crossing. Now, to be sure, there's been some debate about whether Zebedee Coltrane was actually the one to perform the ordinance or not. But what's significant is that Zebedee maintained that he was the one who performed the ordinance and that he had these feelings.
You all talk about how in the early days of Mormonism, how Latter-day Saints mingled with African Americans pretty freely in those early days. And this was part of the reason, as I mentioned in the introduction, that they were expelled from, for example, from Missouri. I mean, their friendship with the black population was pretty controversial.
It was tremendously controversial, so controversial that locals were identifying them as, quote, black Mormons, unquote. They were accusing the Latter-day Saints of supporting interracial marriage, and that was a line that nobody crossed, north, south, east, or west.
But that wasn't true. Mormons didn't, in fact, which we'll get to, by the way. But this was, I think there was even a group in New York you mentioned who were referred to as Black Mormons, even though I don't know if they were associated with the church.
Right.
It was just kind of a nasty term you applied to people who you thought were too close with black people.
There was a theater in New York City where there was there were whites and blacks intermingling as a kind of social statement, and you know, even in New York, they said that this was, you know, an abhorrent behavior for, you know, any civilized person to engage in.
There were a number of abolitionists we should mention within the ranks of early Mormonism, but the faith itself, you couldn't say was abolitionist, was it?
I would not be comfortable saying that, primarily because the Latter-day Saint community was first and foremost focused on survival. They needed to live in the communities in which they were. Now, men like W.W. Phelps, he had certain abolitionist sympathies. There was another man in Cincinnati named Reese E. Price. He was even more radical.
He's a great character, by the way. That you could write a book about him.
He's a fascinating figure.
Yeah.
You could easily write a full biography of his life and times because he's such a colorful man. And that is, you know, that comes later on in the narrative.
Yeah.
But what's noteworthy, though, is that whenever the title of abolitionist was applied to the Latter-day Saints, they worked double time to distance themselves from that label. It was a kind of label that could incite mob riot, as they learned in Jackson County. And really, the consequences of Jackson County would kind of linger over the Latter-day Saint community for the next several years.
So Joseph Smith had these strong principled beliefs that racial inclusion was part of this vision of Zion, but he was also politically astute enough not to say too much of that publicly at some point. Is that fair?
I would say that's fair. In fact, in April of 1836, he wrote an editorial for the Messenger and Advocate in which he defended slavery. But what's noteworthy is that he wrote that article only a few weeks after he personally authorized the ordination of Elijah Abels to the priesthood. So one week he's extolling Elijah's, you know, morality and his virtue and his commitment to the faith. And a few weeks later, he's accusing black people of being essentially sexual predators.
Yeah. What did it mean that Elijah Abels was mixed race? In one sense, as you mentioned in the book, he was identified as a quadroon, which I guess meant he was one quarter African. But talk about that, because it's interesting the way social scientists and people of that era were explaining these so-called mulattoes, was the term, mixed race, that they were somehow less capable of reproducing, that they weren't entirely of one race or another. Talk a little bit about that, because this is an interesting part.
Right. The leading scientific thought of the day was obsessed, fixated on the idea of racial purity. Men like Josiah Nott, you know, he feared that there would be an end to the white race if whites intermingled with blacks, believing that those who came from mixed race were inherently infertile.
Yeah.
You know, it would ultimately cause the end of civilization.
Like a mule.
Essentially, that is where the term mulatto comes from. It's from a man named Edward Long who wrote A History of Jamaica. And when he compared biracial individuals to mules, it really stuck and ended up seeping its way into American discourse.
Did Elijah Abels look to the typical 19th century American like a black man?
Enough that a non-Mormon individual who was unacquainted with the Latter-day Saint community could see him on the streets and refer to him as, quote, a Negro preacher, unquote. So it was black enough to where it would have been noticeable. No one would have said, oh, you know, he's just a white man with a dark complexion. No, everyone knew that he was black.
Yeah. So it happens in the spring of 1836, gives him the Melchizedek priesthood. And I should just explain, this is the higher form of the Mormon priesthood. And according to the records, he becomes an elder. It's a position within the priesthood. Now, you say we talked about Zebedee Coltran and others who were probably uneasy with this idea. And this is kind of the uphill battle that you talked about that Joseph Smith was dealing with. The problems the Mormons had with the people of Missouri, you say, kind of made the early leaders of the church feel like in some way that they were maybe going too far, that they had gone too far. So do they is that fair to say?
I would say that is fair to say. We know in 1836, a few months after Elijah is ordained to the priesthood, the governor of Missouri, Daniel Dunklin, sends a letter to W.W. Phelps and says, you've been called abolitionists, and if you want to be cleared of that, well, that's entirely on you. That is your responsibility. So you need to prove yourselves innocent. And I think all of these comments like those that Joseph Smith made are to that end,
yeah,
trying to distance themselves from that awful appellation of abolitionist. It was seen as something of a terrorist. You were the kind of person who would slip into black communities and try to incite a riot like the Nat Turner Rebellion.
Mm. So Phelps himself is interesting because he himself is an abolitionist in some way, right?
Yes.
But publicly he's saying these things to disassociate himself from the term.
Right. And that's what makes Phelps, you know, such a rich character when it comes to discussing Mormonism's racial history, because he was so committed to the Mormon community that he was willing to not only distance himself from abolitionism, but he was willing to say that we will exclude all blacks from the Mormon community if it means distancing ourselves from abolitionism. There were very few lines he was unwilling to cross in order to accomplish that.
Russell Stevenson is with us. His book is called Black Mormon, The Story of Elijah Abels. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Elijah Abels, an early convert to Mormonism, a friend of Joseph Smith. In fact, Joseph Smith gave him the Mormon priesthood. But of course, the turn here in the story is that he happened to be a black man. The Mormon scholar Russell Stevenson is joining us. His book is called Black Mormon, The Story of Elijah Abels. I want to talk a little bit more about Joseph Smith and how he thought through all of these ideas. Joseph Smith believed that blacks needed to stay within their social boundaries, it seems, that, you know, that they shouldn't intermarry with whites, for example. That seems clear. But he also believed in a kind of upward mobility. What did Joseph Smith really think? Where did he think they fit, black people in society?
Joseph Smith, he embraced the thought of many Northerners in that there was a kind of a ladder of civilization. You know, that there were indeed low blacks, you know, the kinds of blacks that you needed to avoid and that were dangerous, but that eventually a man like Elijah Abels could cultivate himself and become educated and civilized and eventually be the equivalent of, or in certain select cases, superior to certain white individuals. When Orson Hyde questioned Joseph on his views towards black social mobility, Orson Hyde, he was quite worried about this. He said, yeah. Listen, if we enable the black population, they will eventually oppress us. They will rise above us. Huh. And Joseph defended the black population. And he said, you know what? I know some black people who are more civilized and better able to govern than white politicians in Washington, D.C. So Joseph did believe in that a man like Elijah could be worthy of leadership. And he specifically referenced Elijah in this context.
Yeah. It's interesting, that exchange with Orson Hyde, because Hyde asks Smith, what should a man do who came in having 100 slaves? And Smith responds, he should set them free, educate them, and give them equal rights.
Yes. He believed in separation with equality. You know, confine them to their own species is the other part of that quote. So, you know, they shouldn't be, you know, intermarrying. You know, they shouldn't be living in the same vicinity as us, but they should have access to the same goods and services that any white person would.
Let's get back to Elijah Abels himself. 1838, Joseph Smith, this is a year after he's been ordained into the priesthood, Joseph Smith sends him to Canada on a missionary trip. Talk about what kind of missionary was this Elijah Abels, because you say he had a preaching style that was pretty distinctive.
He was a dynamic missionary. He was, I would argue, an unforgettable missionary. Huh. We have correspondence from individuals in his congregation who remembered his preaching 50 years after the fact and would even say that there is no one I'd rather see than Elijah Abels. You know, this is coming from people who have long since left the church. They have nothing to do with Mormonism, or at least not the Mormonism of either the Utah or Josephite brands. Yeah. So they remembered him for being so colorful and for being engaging. And even in spite of all this, they had a hard time coming to grips with what his legacy actually meant. No one really knew what Elijah meant. Did it mean that we were going to have multi-ethnic Zion?
Because that was the reality right there in front of them. There he was, a black man.
Yes. Or are we going to have, you know, a Zion in which there's maybe a few Uncle Toms?
Yeah. You say that Abels felt pretty comfortable speaking with white men on terms of equality. But, and this happens on his mission, some of his missionary associates did not like what that he was, forgive the term, uppity?
He was confident. He felt comfortable wrestling with, you know, with the white men. He felt comfortable giving specific directives to the Mormon community. While Elijah Abels was preaching in Canada, it was not a calm time. We think of Ontario as being, you know, just a bunch of farmland. But in fact, there was a civil war on the brink of explosion in 1838. And it was being incited largely by American vigilantes in upstate New York. There were arms being smuggled across the St. Lawrence Riverway. So as Elijah Abels was preaching to various congregations, at the same time, he recognized that there was significant political unrest. And he even told the Latter-day Saints that they needed to get out immediately. And this struck his fellow white missionary companions, who were not nearly as well informed as he was, as being a little bit alarmist. And Elijah also had the gumption to argue that there would be stakes of Zion in all the world. Now, according to modern Mormonism, that would be—
That's a no-brainer.
That is unconventional. In fact, it's something to be celebrated. But for his missionary companions, that was subversive doctrine because everybody knew that Zion was in Missouri.
Wow. There's even a trial or a hearing held to address these complaints, right? They want to. They hold a trial on the guy.
They do. And there are a number of men who were criticizing him to Joseph's face, and Joseph refused to take any action. And you know, the men who were complaining, they were men of some significance: Jedediah M. Grant, Zenas Gurley, Christopher Merkley. But Joseph Smith refused.
So the Mormons settle eventually. They have some turbulence in Missouri. They settle into a place in Illinois called Nauvoo. And Abels seems to settle in with them, at least at first. Works as a carpenter, you say. Works as an undertaker. Is part of a force that goes to rescue Joseph Smith. I mean, he is absolutely within them. But you also say he negotiates several identities. He's male, he's black, he's a priesthood holder, he's a missionary, you know, at times he's a dissenter. And there's this term you use early in the book also, the preface, where the idea of him sort of having kind of a social interface. We talk about that. I mean, how did he sort of fit in? What was the role that he figured he could play? On one hand, he's smart, he's well-informed, and then, you know, he has to be sort of pushed back from that. I mean, what was the role that he plays?
We see that in its most apparent form when he moved to Cincinnati in 1842. Away from Nauvoo. The exact reasons for moving away, we really don't know the answer to that, and I wouldn't dare speculate on that. But we do know that in Cincinnati he played a prominent role in the Latter-day Saint community. He was a 70. And yet,
let's explain what a 70 is. It's just a for those.
Sure,
who don't
know. Sure. Joseph Smith established quorums of 70 who were meant to be missionaries first and foremost, and it was considered to be a rank above that of elder.
Yeah.
So Elijah Abels was essentially one of the highest ranking members of the Cincinnati Mormon community. Once he moved there, he stepped into something of a thunderstorm, racially speaking. There had been at least two major riots that had embroiled the Cincinnati community over the course of the previous 5 to 7 years. They were quite violent riots, and these riots were focused on abolitionists. Mm. So anyone who was associated with the abolitionist community would be targeted. And this would not exclude members of the Cincinnati Mormons, especially given their past in Jackson County, Missouri.
So there comes a turbulent time for Mormons. And it's interesting. You say it's this time when Joseph Smith is killed. Mm-hmm. 1844 is when Joseph Smith is killed. But in those times, you say that Elijah Abels kind of disappears. for about 2 years.
He does. And, you know,
at least from the record.
Sure, yeah. Sure. And in the first couple of years that he lives in the Cincinnati Mormon community, you know, he finds himself facing some internal opposition yet again. Only this time, he actually understands their criticism and accedes to it. He submits. There had been an incident in some of his preaching activities where he had interacted a little bit too freely with the white community. And given, you know, how tense the situation was, given how abolitionists were often targeted for mob violence, church leadership approached Elijah and said, Brother Abels, we need you to restrict your preaching activities to the black community.
So what you're saying is Elijah Abels figured out – he sort of started to understand what his place would be. That's a terrible way to put it, but right?
You know, when you're put in that kind of position, you need to negotiate identities, as yeah. we were discussing earlier. And if your primary interest is the preservation of the Mormon community – you're willing to sacrifice a certain part of yourself, even if it means your own racial identity.
Yeah.
So this is the beginning of Elijah's silencing. That being said, though, even in 1845, he still had enough clout in the community to call for the excommunication of dissenting Latter-day Saints who dared to criticize the Quorum of the Twelve following Joseph Smith's martyrdom.
Was there anyone else at all like Elijah Abels, black man, somewhat prominent within the Mormon community? Anyone at all?
You know, in 1843, when church leaders approached him about, you know, staying quiet with the white community, there was at least one other black man present. He was a man by the name of Joseph Ball. He was a prominent Latter-day Saint who lived in Massachusetts for a time but had later traveled to Hamilton County, Ohio. So he was there visiting because it was something of a regional conference. So there, Elijah was not the only black Mormon living in Cincinnati, but he was one of very few.
Do we know of any other black men who were ordained to the Mormon priesthood?
Yes, we do. We know of several. There was a man by the name of Walker Lewis, based out of Massachusetts. He was widely praised for his commitment to the church. In fact, at one
Brigham Young quite liked him.
Brigham Young adored Walker Lewis, called him one of the best elders that we have. So he gained wide renown for his commitment to the church, even when other white brethren were beginning to fall away. There was Joseph Ball, of course. There was a man by the name of William McCary who entered the Winter Quarters community.
Fascinating.
He is by far the most dynamic figure in the entire story.
Let's just say this about him. He dressed like an Indian, thought himself to be an Indian to some degree, got himself into trouble because he went a little far in his preachings. Do you want to say something more about that?
Yes. I mean, that does get us a couple of years ahead in the narrative,
right.
But it's fitting. So the Latter-day Saints left Nauvoo in the spring of 1847, and they settled in winter quarters. It's a familiar narrative. One aspect of this narrative that many of us are not familiar with is that there was this man, William McCary, an African-American man, biracial, who tried to pass as a Native American. And this was strategically a wise decision on his part. If you could do it, you should, because life was better for you as a Native American than as an African-American man in antebellum America. Mm. He was a very talented musician, and he was very charming. He married the white daughter of a state president by the name of Daniel Stanton. Her name was Lucy. She would not always use that name. She would end up changing her name later on. And after he married this woman, he proceeded to try to preach to the Winter Quarters community. And they didn't take to that too well. They used several racial epithets. And all this is happening, it's worth noting, when Brigham Young is away. Brigham Young wasn't around for any of this. Brigham Young had a conversation with him. It was very congenial. And then Brigham left. Meanwhile, William McCary is beginning to institute a form of polygamy of the interracial brand.
Yeah.
And that's not going to set well with any white American in 19th century America.
It's another book, by the way, right?
Several books have been written about that topic.
Is that right? So during this turbulent time, as I mentioned, Joseph Smith, of course, is killed.
Yes.
And they turn westward. Spring of 1847, we learn that as he's preparing to head west with the Mormon pioneers, Elijah Abels gets married. He's 37. He weds a 16-year-old girl. Marianne Adams is her name. She was biracial, maybe a runaway slave, we think. I suppose for that time, maybe even for the context of the time, it wasn't that unusual for a man of that age to marry a young person of that age, I suppose.
It was – I'm not going to say that it was pro forma. It wasn't an ordinary experience, but it was common enough to where it would not have scandalized the better part of the contemporary community. And if one were to speculate, you could say that she was indeed a runaway slave and that Elijah took her in and that it that is what gave birth to some kind of romantic relationship.
When we get back from a break, I want to talk about how the church begins to evolve in the way it thinks about race as it heads west, because that seems to be when it starts to evolve. Russell Stevenson is with us. His book is called Black Mormon, The Story of Elijah Abels. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the scholar Russell Stevenson. We're talking about his book, Black Mormon, The Story of Elijah Abels. So I want to talk to you about, as the Mormons begin to head west, the story begins to change. Joseph Smith, who seems, I think it's fair to say, the main pillar of support for including blacks in the Mormon experience.
Yes, absolutely. Right. If it were not for Joseph Smith or Brigham Young's loyalty to Joseph Smith, yeah, then my speculation would be that Elijah Abels could not have survived in the Mormon community.
But that pillar's gone now. In 1844, Joseph Smith is killed. And here's something you write about. You cite Brigham Young. This is 1847. He writes this. He believes in the inclusion of blacks in the church, and he told one black person, here's the quote, "It is nothing to do with blood. For of one blood has God made all flesh." So that's 1847, Brigham Young supporting this idea of inclusion. But then things begin to change because you write about how Brigham Young began to tire, is how you put it, of Joseph Smith's experiment. Talk about how things start to evolve now.
We touched on this a few moments ago with the events surrounding William McCary. What happened was William McCary, he implemented this form of interracial polygamy in Brigham Young's absence, mind you.
Right.
And this caused the Latter-day Saints to almost rise up in a populist revolt against the black component of the Mormon community. William McCary had just crossed so many lines that they could not abide him any longer. In winter of 1847, December to be exact, Brigham Young returns to winter quarters to check up on affairs. And the local leadership, having had to just deal with the fallout of William McCary, they discuss matters with Brigham Young. Hmm. And while Brigham Young did not object to this man's marrying a white woman, or at least he didn't openly object to it, he didn't make any open criticisms, he did object to one interracial polygamy. I mean, polygamy unauthorized was still considered to be taboo. It was something of an open secret within the winter quarters community. And to make matters worse, he heard that there was a black Mormon whose son had married a white woman in Massachusetts. So the William McCary experience coupled with this news, it pushed too many buttons. And what's noteworthy about this meeting is that when Brigham Young was notified of all these things, it reveals the contradictions that he struggled with internally.
Right.
Within one breath, he at once said that interracial couples deserved death for their sin, but then in the next breath, saying that they deserved temple blessings. So he couldn't quite decide what interracial marriage meant to him.
There's also a bit of irony here in that early Mormon leaders felt uncomfortable with Joseph Smith's policies of racial inclusion. They thought, as you put it in the book, that this would overturn their social order But then they go ahead and embrace polygamy, you know, which totally overturns the social order. I mean, your book isn't about that, but what do you make of that?
And that is a tremendous contradiction. And adding to that, Eastern commentators consistently used racialized epithets to describe the Mormon people. It had been known for people to draw political cartoons depicting Brigham Young having, several wives, some of them being African American or of other ethnicities. So polygamy was associated with blackness to some degree. So the fact that they were willing to embrace blackness in their social systems while eschewing blackness in all other aspects of their lives, I mean, that really cuts to the contradiction of this time period. And it really highlights what can happen when a people embrace a collective sin. I mean, collective sins, they invite contradictions. They invite self-deception. And that's what's going to happen.
There's a point at which the Mormon people then begin, of course, to transition away from the idea of racial inclusion. And you talk about how it's not a direct switch, seem to be precipitated by this move west in some way. I mean, if this is going to be if we're headed now to this new religious utopia, it seems they saw it as a place where people of other races might not belong. I mean, because you talk about it as this new racial community.
Yes, and it was a racial community that celebrated many of the same things that, the Eastern states did. White Anglo-Saxons. Except instead of, adding the Protestant at the end, it was, there were WASMs rather than WASPs. So the white Mormon community, they felt a need to distance themselves from all things in the East. And as they envisioned the East, they envisioned it, especially the South, as a place in which races mingled all too freely through slavery, and they wanted no part of that. So they began to identify themselves as a pure white Zion.
And it seems now at this point, Russell Stevenson, that we start to see the language that persisted in Mormonism for decades, this idea that connects blacks and the priesthood to this idea of worthiness, and worthiness even in what Mormons believe was the preexistence.
Yes, and that is a doctrinal development that it doesn't start with even Brigham Young. It tends to start a little bit later towards the 1860s and 1870s. Brigham Young's justification for racial exclusion was a pretty old school Protestantism.
Yeah.
He drew upon the ideas of the curse of Cain and the curse of Ham, and that these individuals were inherently ill fit for leadership, and they certainly did not we're not in a position to receive any kind of power within any white community. So as far as Brigham Young was concerned, black people were put on earth to serve. Now, there should be a kind of a benevolent system put in place to protect black people from the worst abuses of the Southern slave system. But even still, he believed in the fundamental social order at this point. It's a pretty terrible transformation that he goes through, but it is a transformation that took place.
I want to go back to what you were saying about Brigham Young, some of his comments, because it seems like with Joseph Smith out of the way, that's a crass way of putting it, but Joseph Smith no longer, Brigham Young's in charge now. You talk about the conflicts that he's feeling. You talk about how Brigham Young, for example, Elijah Abels in 1853 asks Brigham Young for access to the Mormon temple. Brigham Young puts him off. And you have Brigham Young earlier who says, not so long before that, the color doesn't really matter. But now his comments about race start to get more strident. And I think this is what you were referring to. You say that if a white person mingled his seed with a black person, and here's the quote, the only way he could get rid of it or have salvation would be to come forward and have his head cut off and spill his blood upon the ground. And he says this about black people in 1863. They are uncouth, they're uncomely, they're disagreeable, low in their habits, wild, and seemingly deprived of nearly all the blessings of intelligence that is generally bestowed upon mankind. So what's the real Brigham Young?
You see, and that is, that is one of the million-dollar questions, right? And the evidence suggests that, you know, back in his inclusive days, Brigham Young embraced Joseph Smith's vision. And Brigham Young's loyalty to Joseph Smith was tremendous. He found a connection to Joseph Smith that he had seldom found in his life, and it was a connection that would fire much of his being. But as they began to separate themselves from the Eastern United States, as they began to see themselves as a community unto themselves, semi-independent, mentally, Brigham Young began to eschew any kinds of trappings of what he felt had dragged the Mormon community down over the course of the past 17 years. As much as Brigham Young loved Joseph Smith, there were certain things where he felt that Joseph Smith may have gone too far. And he was willing to abide Joseph's experiment with black inclusion, but then with the William McCary news, with the news of the interracial marriage in Massachusetts. It was too much. He cracked.
Let's take a call. Kent is joining us in Salt Lake. Kent, sorry for the wait. Glad you did.
That's all right. I'm just interested. As the author probably knows, there's a monument to Elijah Abel in the Salt Lake City Cemetery, and it mentions that his ordination was renewed in 1841 while Joseph Smith was alive. But it seems like both he and Jane James were found the situation changed considerably once they had arrived in the Utah Territory and under the leadership of Brigham Young. So I'm just wondering if it's really not that clear that Brigham Young simply didn't want blacks to be able to fully participate or not.
You know, that's a great question, Ken. Thank you so much for asking. That Brigham Young wanted blacks to be part of the church is clear in March of 1847. We have the minutes. Thomas Bullock was there. He took excellent notes, and that is unambiguous. So what we see happening is that Brigham Young made a decision based on, you know, his already inbred reticence to embrace blacks, but yet he was, you know, again, he was willing to endure Joseph Smith's experiment. I would say his commitment to black inclusion was based on his loyalty to Joseph Smith rather than his own personal feelings. But then once, you know, the William McCary incident had happened, and once he had found out the news about the interracial marriage in Massachusetts, it crossed lines for him that he could just not abide.
What happens to Elijah Abel's? Moves to Ogden for a time. It's interesting.
He does.
You say that he and his wife start putting on these minstrel shows. They had a number of children. She dies the same year Brigham Young dies, his wife. And you say that same year Elijah Abel's approaches the new Mormon prophet, John Taylor, again, who wants access to the temple again. So he asks Taylor, who turns him down. And not only that, he says that Joseph Smith, in fact, had made a mistake by ordaining him in the first place.
Yes. So Elijah approached church leadership in 1879, a couple of years after his spouse's death, believing that with Brigham Young now deceased, that maybe they would make a decision that was a better suited for him. And he wanted his endowment badly. It's worth noting that he never
lost.
That
means he wants to go to the temple.
Yes, yes. The temple wasn't constructed at this point, yeah, or at least anywhere nearby him. But he did want his endowment. And he believed that, you know, he could have it. You know, he was once a fixture in the Mormon community.
Yeah. But
he was not given it.
Yeah. And I think this is interesting. It seems like I just think it's interesting that Taylor says, in fact, Smith had made a mistake. And you hear even later other Mormon prophets saying that didn't happen at all. I mean, they're starting to sort of rework the story.
Yes. So the response to Elijah was they acknowledged his faithfulness and they acknowledged his priesthood, but they said that anyone with a drop of blood from the line of Ham in them could not be given the priesthood. And around the same time, we're seeing the premortal doctrine rise up as well. And that is one of the larger themes, is just a variety of different justifications being used, whether the premortal, you know, the premortality explanation or the lineage explanation. They're trying to use any of these things to justify keeping black people out of the body of the priesthood.
In the book, you put it this way. You say that God's chosen people had erected an idol of racial difference. And that question always comes up. We've got about a minute or so left. Maybe it's unfair to ask such a deep question with that little time. But the question comes up, was it doctrine? Was it God who wanted this? Or was this just people who are trying to figure out their own sort of racial ideas and make it fit?
You know, my short answer to this is that the Latter-day Saints' identification as a people of Israel is informative here. The ancient Israelites' number one sin was idolatry. It didn't make them any less a covenant people. They were still God's people. But they engaged in a collective sin. And collective sin is a familiar component of Mormon theology. You can find it throughout the standard works, Doctrine and Covenants, Old Testament, New Testament, Book of Mormon.
Let me sneak in another little question, because I think it's interesting. You talk about how Elijah Abels had a prescient vision for a global Zion, that he sort of foresaw this Mormonism in the 21st century. Will you say something about that, Frank?
Sure, sure. One of his comments during the 1879 meeting is that he would, quote, be the initiative authority by which my race will be redeemed, unquote. Now, that might sound like something of a racist comment, but it was recorded through a white lens. And it's interesting that in 1973, when Lester Bush wrote his article, Mormonism's Negro Doctrine, it brought to life Elijah's life again to church leadership. And that played a key role in their deciding to issue Official Declaration Number 2.
It's Russell Stevenson. His book is called Black Mormon, The Story of Elijah Abels. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.